The first thing I want to say is this is not dress rehearsal. Live the life that you want to live, okay? A lot of times we get hung up on titles and position, and I work for this place. Focus on the things that you like to do. I ask people, how would you...
Leadership isn't about being an authority. It isn't about having charisma or being in control or knowing all the answers. So what does it mean to be a leader? That's what we're here to find out. I'm Nicholas, your host, founder of Eagle Transformational Coaching. Come and join us as we sit down with amazing leaders from all walks of life. Let's transform today's leadership into effective leadership here on the Life I Lead podcast. Well, 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 welcome to another edition of the Life I Lead podcast. I'm Nicholas, your host and founder of Eagle Transformational Coaching. Today, I interview an incredible lady, Brenda Harrington. She's calling us from just outside Washington. She's a certified executive coach and the founder of Adaptive Leadership Strategies. And she works with leaders globally in public and private and government and intergovernmental, humanitarian and non-for-profit organizations. She's got more than 30 years experience in private industry, from first level management to senior executive and C-suite. She's a graduate of Georgetown University Leadership Coaching Program and is credentialed member of the International Coaching Federation. And she's just released her book, Access Denied. And this book, if I summed this book up, this is what the headline of her book says. When all you hear is that you can't or that you shouldn't, chances are that you don't and you won't. In many cases, can't means that you can, and often means, yes, you should. What an incredible and enticing title to her book. We talk about everything from current state of the United States leadership to struggles in adaptability, flexibility in leadership. I thoroughly enjoyed this interview. I hope you do too. So sit back and listen to Brenda Harrington. So without further ado, let me bring Brenda Harrington to the microphone. Brenda, thank you very much for approaching The Life I Lead. It's on the back of an amazing book, which you've penned, which we'll get to in the minute. You are a certified executive coach. You're a founder of an organization. You've worked with a diverse group of people. Tell us a little bit in your own words about where you are today and what's brought you briefly to this day.
Wow. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Where I am today, I don't mean to be cliche, but I truly feel that I am living my best life. And, wow. And what I mean by that is, you know, getting to a place where you can make choices truly and be selective and really be thoughtful about what you want to do and how you want to spend your time. Yeah. I have spent more than 30, probably 40-ish years at this point in, you know, working in private industry in different positions, ranging from first line management to senior level executive leadership. And about 12 years ago, I decided that I really wanted to take the wheel when it came to the last chapter, the remaining chapter, if you will, of my professional life. And that's when I founded Adaptive Leadership Strategies, because what I learned over and over again is that when you get the people part right, amazing things can happen. And yes, you know, we can focus on the bottom line and the top line and the return on we do all that, but it's the people part that makes all that work. And so that's where I really wanted to spend my time. And I'm grateful that I was able to put together the pieces that allow me to do that.
I'm really interested in the name of your organization, Adaptive Leadership Strategy. Tell me why you think adaptive or adaptation is so key to leadership.
Especially now, you've got to be willing to be curious. You've got to be willing to be innovative and creative. Okay, no two circumstances are the same. No two people are the same. And if we really look at the substance of the essence of what leadership is, it's not about titles or positions or where you sit in an organization. and certainly where you sit in the building. It is about the connection you're able to make with people. And so being nimble, being willing to adapt, being willing to look at things with a fresh set of eyes every time is critical.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you lined up a load of coaches, executive coaches, and you'd say, what's a really key important aspect of leadership? And some people would say servanthood, some people would say vulnerability, others would say management skills. And it's interesting that you say adaptability or flexibility.
Yeah.
One of the pushes of my organization is the connection, the book I wrote called The Life I Lead. And it's a connectivity between the habits you create in life and the way that they land to create effective leadership. Do you think there is adaptability that people naturally live as husbands, wives, partners, children, that is not connected to the way that they are adaptable at work or in the office or in leadership? Or do you think that they are two completely different spheres of people's lives?
I don't think they're two completely different spheres of people's lives. I think that the way a person is in his or her or their personal lives is a lot of, what contributes to how they show up in the workplace. Okay.
Yeah.
And so perhaps the word adaptive is a reflection. It certainly is a reflection of how I've always lived my life. And, I think of conversations that I've had with people who are a lot more rigid, perhaps have less of a risk tolerance, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, why are you doing that? Or aren't you afraid? Or what if this happens? What if that happens? I'm not one of those people. I prefer not to ask, what if, and, really pose the question, why not? What's the worst that could happen, right?
Yeah.
And I know that everybody's not comfortable with that. But I think that if you're going to take on the challenge, and I will say the honor, the privilege of leading others, toward a common goal, you've got to be willing to step into that space.
I think that's an incredibly insightful, and it leads me on to, one of the things I read about you was this concept that when all you hear is you can't or that you shouldn't, chances are that you don't and you won't. And in many cases, can't means you can, and shouldn't often means yes, you should. Unpack that for me. That really stood out on the page for me.
Yeah, and so that is the header on the website for my book, Access Denied.
Uh-huh.
And, words are powerful. Vocabulary, is really so meaningful. And I think that we really take the messaging to heart from the time we were very young children, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And when we hear that type of negative messaging, it can become a reality unless we're willing to question it. Okay, and that's where curiosity becomes so important, and the willingness to really juxtapose what you're hearing with what you're feeling,
yeah.
right? Why can't I? Why am I not good enough? Why do you think this won't work for me, right? And so much of the time, that messaging that we receive has less to do with us and more to do with the other, the person who is sharing that messaging.
And just to push on that, you're right, because I think if you're receiving negativity or you're receiving something that is not settling with your character and your grounding, you know who you are, it's very easy to be able to challenge that, but it's very difficult to challenge it without feeling like a teenager, like a stroppy 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. I say to my 9-year-old, do something. She's like, Daddy, why am I doing this? How do we transfer being able to counter negative dissemination? If I'm receiving negativity from a really crappy leader, a really crappy boss, and they don't know how to swing this positively, how do I challenge that? How do I challenge that without becoming that sort of self-confirmed 14-year-old who's just been told to tidy their room?
In coaching, we use the term, the observer I am.
Yeah.
And it really requires you to be intentional about taking a step back and trying to be objective, right? When I talk to leaders, for example, this is a little harder to do with self, but I just want to use this as a little bit of a metaphor to set this up. So when I talk to leaders about organizational and team challenges, you know, one of the things I say is take the names off the org chart and really just look at this as in the form of almost constellations. What's best for the organization? What's best for the desired outcome? Where are you trying to go? And often we come up with a very different result. And so if you can take that step back and really think and look as objectively as you can, maybe even soliciting input from others. I talk a lot in the book about seating your own board of advisors beyond having a mentor, right?
Yeah.
Just inviting other people into the conversation and really doing an assessment of the reality of what's happened. You can never rely on one lens, not your own and not one other person's, okay?
I think that's really interesting to hear you say everyone needs their board of advisors. You know, I say exactly the same for people generally in life. You know, you must have your counsel, your board of directors around you, who you're surrounding yourself with. I think that's really important. If we're finding that we're working, we're being led by a very fixed, non-agile, non-adapting environment, firstly, how do we identify that? What are the triggers where we're seeing, you know, this is not necessarily about being led by, you know, Bernard, who's particularly traditional or rigid. This is an organizational issue that there is really no adaptability. There's no flexibility. Thus, my skills, my passions, my ability as a person, as an employee, as a great follower, aren't working. How do I identify that? It's easy to moan about it, but how do I see it first?
Yeah, I say you can have a pity party for 5 minutes, then you need to come up with a strategy, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's time to move forward, right? Eat your ice cream, shed your tears, whatever it is you do, and then go to work. You know, it is so difficult, especially when people allow emotions to get in the way. I always wanted to be a part of this firm. I always envisioned myself, you know, in this role, in this organization. What is the phrase? Culture eats strategy, breakfast, lunch, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You've got to pay attention to what's happening. Pay attention to what is tolerated. Pay attention to what is rewarded. Okay. And sometimes the answer is tough. Maybe that's not the place where you can thrive.
Yeah.
That's the reality.
Yeah.
All right. And so if you're not able to, when you start to look at things through a more strategic lens, And you take a look at what's happening, what is playing out, who the decision makers are, who the power players are. And that's not always leadership. There's a lot of informal leadership in organizations, right? So you really have to be willing to pay attention to those things and be honest about your findings.
Now, Brenda, tell us about the book, Access Denied. The title itself is exciting. Tell us what it was born from and what you intended to do.
It was born from the events of the spring of 2020 that took place here in the United States, one after another. I don't have to repeat.
Yeah.
Okay. It hit me as a call to action, not so much because of what occurred, sadly, but because it was still occurring at the levels that it's taking place and the conversations that ensued. The conversations, you know, were just, you know, I didn't know, and I didn't realize this was going on, and this is such a surprise. Well, it's, for many of us, it's not a surprise, right? It's our reality.
Yeah.
And so I don't have a platform. I'm not Oprah Winfrey. I'm not, you know, but I wanted to start a meaningful conversation. And so the book is a compilation of stories, each of which is an archetype, if you will, for different workplace circumstances. A couple of my own stories are included. But beyond telling the stories, I wanted to provide coaching and reflection tools for people to process and think through. Because a lot of times we experience these things and we acquiesce, we accept them, and we don't think about the choices we have. I would argue that we always have a choice to make. It doesn't mean that you need to be disrespectful. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, act in an inappropriate way. But there's always an approach to addressing these things, to move things in a different direction or not, which is something that you need to know.
And can I ask you, do you think that this, it's interesting that the events of 2020, and I know you said particularly in the US, and I wrote a chapter in my book about the same thing, and it wasn't, and I decided that I don't think this is a US problem. I think this is a global democratic problem. Do you think this is a cultural change that's needed about how we follow, how we lead? My title for the chapter that you have just reminded me of was called Don't Renew Your Mob Mentality. You know, and I think it was very easy. It's so interesting to hear you say, oh, well, I didn't know. We didn't know that that would cause this. And we didn't see that coming down the tracks. And we weren't really sure, you know, that wasn't our intention. You know, for a lot of us sat watching this from the outside, this was just bullshit. It was flannel. It was rubbish.
Totally.
You know, and it was so smoke and mirrors. But is this reaction to it that now sort of drifts through the history of time, it will drift through generations that year, you know, among world leaders, among democracy itself and dictatorship, and amongst how we now teach our children about the risks of mob rule and mob reaction? Do you think it's changed culture? Do you think it needs to change culture?
I don't think enough is changing. And I don't know what's happening where you are, but I can say that here in the United States, there was such a strong push from mid-2020 through maybe mid-2021, which is now waning.
Yeah.
Right. And part of that is decisions that have come down, the Supreme Court decision about affirmative action, and then all of this push to remove books from shelves and water down, you know, history and things like that, and really almost regulate how history is taught. You cannot address American history without talking about slavery and Jim Crow and all of these things.
Yeah.
But nobody really wants, the majority doesn't want to talk about that because they don't want people to feel bad. Well, just think about the feelings, you know, that are carried by the people who experienced it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing with the book is that I really wanted to give people tools, because people say to me all the time, well, what should I say? What should I have done? What can I do? I think any time you experience something and you don't call it out is a missed opportunity. Okay. I think that you send the wrong message, because what you're signaling is that it's okay. You know, continue to disrespect me, continue to pretend I'm invisible, continue to overlook my credentials and my competencies. I'm fine with it. And it's not fine.
Mm.
So I think, you know, death by a thousand cuts, right? So I think each and every one of us, whether we're impacted, whether we've identified ourselves, as someone's identifying themselves as an ally. I was at a conference last week and a woman said, you know, rather than use the term ally, I prefer the word accomplice. So I'm gonna borrow that from her, right? but I think we all, if we really are committed to the idea of inclusion and the more equitable circumstances for everyone, we can't be, it's not a spectator sport. We've got to be intentional and we've got to be active and we've got to show up.
I think that's right. I think there's a huge risk, and I think there's a huge risk to perception that people see a lot of this as lip service.
Right.
You know, my wife is in corporate world, and she works in central London in an international company, and she's on various panels for inclusion or, you know, to break down barriers. And a lot of it, I sit there and I chat with her at dinner and I think, do you know, a lot of this is absolute crap. This is tick, you know, box ticking memorandum, put it on an agenda and that's it, done. A bit like health and safety, you know, we need the health and safety man who's coming around to check that we're putting the chairs out for assembly correctly. You know, when does it stop becoming lip service and people are saying, this is actually discrimination, this is actually unequal, and these processes aren't working?
So someone came to me, I'm going to sanitize this, but I think this is timely. This is a perfect example. A colleague came to me this week and asked if I was available to participate in a program. The program for this organization has four components. Let's say one of them is around generational diversity, working with different age cohorts, right? And let's say a second one is around communication. The other two touch on diversity and equity. These are supposed to be 1-hour sessions delivered to groups that are 30 or 40 people in number for each group over the course of a few months. My response was, I'm happy to talk about the generations. I'm happy to talk about communication. I'm not going to participate in a 1-hour conversation under any circumstances about diversity or equity. And he came back and he said, well, I understand your concern, but this is part of a much larger effort toward diversity by the company. And so I said, well, let me go to this website. So I went to the website to look at the, the yearbook picture, right? Our leaders, right? 5 white men and 1 white woman.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, I said, you know, my values and my commitment to this are deep. I said, I'd have to know so much more about this larger commitment, which is not appropriate nor efficient for this purpose. So happy to talk about the generations. Happy to talk about, communication, not talking to anybody for 1 hour, a group of 50, about diversity.
Mm.
Done. And those are the kinds of things, you know. Now, if this were, day one of, turning the lights on and I was focused on the economics and I needed the money, it might have been harder to make that decision. I would hope that I would still have gone in the same direction. But for no amount of money, is it worth it? It's just sending the wrong message. And those are the kinds of decisions I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You use the term box ticking. Some of the efforts, I'm using my air quotes,
yeah,
that I see, and I'm sure you do too, toward addressing inclusion and diversity are just egregious. They're ridiculous.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so what's the... the key things that organizations, doesn't matter about the size or the profit margin or whatever, the wealth of these organizations, what are the few things that they should be doing to counteract this box ticking rubbish, that is offensive, that it's ineffectual, that is, does more harm than good? What's the premise? We start with what?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you can't change hearts and minds, but to be honest. So hearts and minds can change, all right? But I think that there's got to be a true and sincere and authentic commitment on the part of the leaders around their why. Why are they doing this? Yes, it's good for business and all these, but there's also a moral imperative, in my opinion. So you really want to see if that holds water, if you will.
Yeah.
In terms of where they're coming from with the effort. And it's something that has to happen over time. Not only that, but there's got to be accountability. And this is where we fall down. Because, they sponsor the training, they buy everybody lunch, and then they turn their backs, right? and you still have this one person who's there. So the numbers look good. You've got the right percentages, if you will. But this person is not being included. They're not being engaged. They're not being developed, and nobody's being held accountable for that.
Yeah.
And so it really has got to be part of the fabric of the organization at every level. If there's intention and there's commitment behind improving the circumstances,
and for the John Doe, the Joe Bloggs, who's going to work. And he or she is living and working in this environment that they know is surrounded with this crap. What is their responsibility? This isn't about pushing it out and going, well, this is management's issue. This is leadership problem. This is companies. We all have to take a little bite of the cherry here and say, this is what I need to do. What do these people need to do? Listening to this, thinking, yeah, I'm in that position. My leader's an absolute idiot when it comes to this. But the responsibility is with them as well. Give us some advice.
And that's what the book is about. So that's why there's so many questions.
Brilliant.
And exercises and things in the book, because I think that people are at a loss for what to say. I need my job. I have a mortgage. I have a family. I have responsibilities. I think, though, you have an opportunity to test the water. Okay. You have an opportunity to say, you know, I'd like to talk to you, boss, about that conversation we had yesterday, or, you know, that thing that came up. How did you feel about that? Because you need to know first. And I have this, I'm sure you do too, have this conversation with clients. So often we launch into a discussion or a conversation before we know what kind of conversation we can have.
Yes.
Okay. And so you've gone down the road, the things you can't unsay, the things you can't undo, this is too late. So to a question like that, you may get one of a few responses that might say, oh, I didn't realize. I'm sorry. I apologize. Tell me, you know, how I should have approached it, or you know, how should we address this? Or you might get, what was wrong with that? I didn't see anything wrong with that. What's the problem? Mm-hmm. So then you know what you're dealing with, right? And that you need to know first. And so when I talk about paying attention, really, not everybody's got head down, focused on doing the work. You know, I'm going to do a better job. They're going to recognize me. Not going to happen. Just pay attention to what's going on. Right.
Yeah.
And then you know what's possible.
Yeah.
Then you know what's possible. The other thing is that we tend to just focus on the work. We don't think about the social aspects because a lot of it's uncomfortable. We don't have the same interests. We don't have the same, you know, all this. You've got to pay attention to what's going on outside of the conference room. So if it's a happy hour, if it's a rugby game, if it's whatever, an outing, you've got to participate in those things and really pay attention to those relationships that are being cultivated outside of the office. And because all of that has an impact on our reality, on our work reality.
It's a huge question and one that you couldn't possibly cover very quickly, but in your expertise, in your vision, in your, you know, laser sharp dealing with this environment, what does inclusion and equity in the workplace look like at minimum? What does it look like at a foundation level? I'm not talking about the ideal, I'm not talking about Narnia, but, you know, at the basis, this is what we need in place.
Include me. Just, you know, don't treat me as though I'm invisible. Yes, I'm in the room, but, you know, ask for my perspective. Engage me to be part of decision making. You know, include, you know, take my lens into consideration.
Yeah.
So often the input and the opinions are discredited and marginalized and set aside as being insignificant. But that's part of seeing me as less than human, or seeing me as less, being less intelligent, and things like, you know, all of that. Just that's where it comes from. But really, let me participate. Let me add value and let me play a meaningful role in what I'm there to do.
I used to, in a very long and distant previous existence, I studied to be an ordained minister. And there was this belief that when a guy was chosen as a priest to become a bishop, that he was sent away to this mysterious house somewhere. And he was taught three things. He was taught to sort of shuffle with his skull cap, straighten his episcopal ring, and play with that enormous cross that hangs around his neck. And they became traits of, and if you watch any bishop talking, that's what they do. If you watch Prince Charles, King Charles speaking, he has this wonderful busyness of playing with his cufflinks in his jacket, keep himself busy. There's something that happens to people when they hit CEO leadership level, that they get taken to this mysterious house and they completely forget their entire journey to what took them to that office. And it's really strange, isn't it? Because it's one of the things I think about all the time. And I work with clients all the time. And I sit there and listen to some people in leadership. And I'm like, where the hell do you get off thinking like this? Were you not at that point once?
Yeah.
What happens to people that they go through this sort of mysterious wardrobe and come out the other end, this package of crap that they can't remember how to, with just the basic etiquette to invite somebody to contribute,
yeah,
to get a perspective, to get a point of view. Do you think that, is that worldwide? Do you experience that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As if they, you know, came through the birth canal with the CEO title. Absolutely. I mean, it's just, It's insane, right? It's insane. But there are layers to that, you know, because their walk and reality certainly has been very different in many cases than mine.
Yeah.
And so there's this underlying belief, and I'll say in some cases fear, that I might be as smart, or I might be a little smarter, right? Or I might add value. You know, many leaders believe that they have to have all the answers. That's a whole nother, you know, issue. But that they should know it all, and they need to be the smartest person in the room. And that's the first thing from the truth, as you know. You know, and so they first have to, I say, get right with what leadership is and understand that, yeah, you know, that's not why they're there. And so it really depends on how they're showing up as a leader and what their leadership intention is. But no, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's like, do you have any recollection of what got you to this place?
It's like sitting on the couch. And you go, well, of course you're going to be like that because you weren't breastfed as a child. And you think, well, I don't remember ever being breastfed or not being breastfed, but it's obviously a package of who I am today. And then, like, do you not remember your boss 20 years ago? Do you not remember being the person at the coalface? Really interesting.
Right.
What do you think are, you know, since pandemic, and I don't use that as an excuse, I use it as sort of a chapter in the history of society and social culture. What do you think are the biggest risks currently to leadership? You know, if I think about the UK, I think about things like the NHS, and I know that that is unsustainable in its present form. I think about the way we educate our children, and I don't think that's suitable for the current citizens we need in the world. You know, I don't think that our military capabilities as nations is sustainable for world peace. And I don't think democracy in its current state will last, because if you put democracy in the hands of a mob, it's a great risk. What do you think are the huge risks to current leadership and its longevity or sustainability?
Complacency and reliance on, you know, best practices.
Yeah. Okay.
Either explicitly or just conceptually. And I think a willingness, going back to that fundamental premise of adaptability, you know, just a willingness to step away. It's frightening for people. Because when you think about, you know, the old paradigm, I say, you go to school, you know, you go to university, you're educated, you work, you retire. That's not where we are anymore. Lifelong learning. Things are changing.
Brilliant.
Hourly, daily, right? You know, so you've got to keep up with that. And that's scary for people. It's exhausting, but it's scary for people because they think they should know it all. I'm 40, 50, 60 years old. I should know this. This is day one for all of us. Okay. Yeah. We are in a different environment. And I think the acceptance of that is really very important. Now, I want to go back to your question, if I might, about the name of the company. Quite frankly, you know, when I was looking for names, and I wanted the name to reflect or convey what it was we were going to be doing. So that was a big part of it. You may be familiar with Ron Heifetz out of Harvard,
yeah,
who developed the adaptive leadership model, which is something that I've never studied under him. I know several people who have, but it's something that I definitely align with and
yes,
believe in.
Yeah,
you know, and he talks about, you know, making a distinction between adaptive problems and technical problems. Right, an adaptive problem is something that is just so new to you. You've never seen before. You're unfamiliar with. You're not sure how to solve, and so it's important to bring in other voices, invite other people into the conversation. But the idea of treating your space as a leader as a laboratory, leadership laboratory, and just being willing to experiment a little bit and take risks and take chances and try some different things is crucial right now. Absolutely crucial. And I think that anyone who is not willing to at least incorporate some of that approach to what they're doing in a leadership role should step aside.
Yes. Yeah. It's an interesting concept, this stepping aside. For some reason, the CEO role, the upper echelons of leadership role, there is a real reluctancy to step aside. And it might be generational, I don't know, but there comes a point, well, I would say that probably 6 out of 10 upper high level leaders aren't daily learners. They're daily livers. They, you know, they go to the office, they run their board, but they're not daily learners. You know, and I don't believe you can be a leader without learning daily. But there is this reluctance to say, do you know what? I've hit the point where I'm not going to bring any more to this table without being able to delegate to fresher, brighter, sparklier eyes than mine. Why is that?
You know, I think it's a component of self-actualization, honestly. I think that, you know, people step into their own belief of who they should be and what they want for themselves. And it becomes a me effort instead of a we effort. And that's a lot of what we experience or live, you know, politically. And I'll leave that there. I won't go any farther with that, but nevertheless. Yeah. But there's another facet or aspect to that, and it's the leaders who can't get out of the weeds. It's that they continue to do more of whatever it is they did before they were in, you know, the C-suite, the CEO role. They can't get out of everybody else's space.
Yeah.
And no, there's an awful lot of that. There's an awful lot of that. And I think it's fear. You know, if I step aside, people realize when they've reached their limits, the limitations, but then who else will I be? What will I do? Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, they're looking for the wrong solutions. I think
it's the fear of that huge gap in their calendar, isn't it? It's that, you're right. It's that, what else have I got? What else do I do?
And in a lot of cases, the learning, you know, that we've been talking about is a good starting point, but they're afraid to move in that direction, perhaps.
Give us an insight, Brenda, if you will. I'm a huge believer, the more I work with leaders and aspiring leaders or those in followership, that we have a real crisis of motivation and that people are no longer necessarily, regardless of the cost of living crisis that we're in, people are no longer necessarily motivated by salary. No, there's this concept that, you know, if you pay me an extra £10,000 a year, I'm going to be more profitable, or I'm going to be a lot more loyal, or I'm going to be more trustworthy, or I'm going to go above and beyond. And that doesn't work now. It might have worked even 10 or 15 years ago in the boom of the bonuses. It doesn't work now. And I think that there's a huge struggle in leaders to know how to, one, approach finding out what motivates my team or finding out what motivates my, organization, but also what as a follower motivates me.
I think it comes down to purpose. People are paying a lot more attention to value alignment, you know, what matters to them and what creates meaning for them.
Okay.
And I don't know that people are as willing to make a distinction between what they do for a living and who they are. Okay, because we spend so much time in the workplace and we're connected, right? 24/7, you've got your devices, you got, you know, all that. So there really needs to be, you know, you need to be able to zip those things together, at least, you know, bring them more closely together. And so you're right. I mean, I think so many people have come to realize or understand that money does not equate to happiness. And whether it's, you know, based on their journey, the life they've lived to whatever point, or, you know, watching their parents or colleagues or friends go through. And I think that you referenced the pandemic earlier, we had a lot of time to think and process. And a lot of people started to really question what they were doing with their lives, how they were spending their time. And they got to understand how their employers felt about them. You know, if you listen to the experiences of people during the pandemic, you know, they vary considerably in terms of how organizations responded to everything from, you know, working remotely to caring for family and relatives and things like that. So I think that we're in a period of a significant reset, and it's not over.
And if a leader, dare I say, had the vulnerability and open-heartedness to sit in his car on his way to work thinking, you know what, that's me. I'm really struggling in this sphere at the moment. I'm struggling with how to motivate my team, you know, because I can't, one, I might not be able to afford to financially incentivize them, or I know it doesn't work because I've tried it. What other things should they be looking at, do you think?
Well, that whole, how do I motivate my team? I think that motivation comes from within, and you've got to ask some hard questions. What's important to you? You know, what are you interested in? What do you want to do? What's working? What could work better? You know, and try to find a space for that. You might not be able to do everything, but people want to be seen and they want to be heard. It's not that hard.
No.
And if you're willing to hold a space for people to engage with you in that way, I mean, you can get a fair amount of mileage out of that. Not to say that people aren't struggling financially and that there doesn't need to be some attention to consideration, but if you can work with someone in some of those other personal areas, you know, of their lives and of their being, that's it. You really can make some meaningful change, I believe.
Thank you. That's an inspiration. I always ask my guests, because we talk primarily about leadership, but it's often leadership that they're used to working with or working for. And I always say a lot of people who listen to this podcast will be on their way to work. They'll be running out of the house. They'll be on the school run. They might be in a really demotivating, demoralizing, you know, I need to go to work because I need to pay the bills sort of position. And I try to say to people, keep going or cut loose and make a fresh start. Give us some motivation for those in followership that are really struggling right now.
The first thing I want to say is this is not dress rehearsal. This is not dress rehearsal.
Brilliant.
Live the life that you want to live, okay? A lot of times we get hung up on titles and position, and I work for this place. Focus on the things that you like to do. I ask people, how would you spend your time? If compensation, money, obligations have nothing to do with it, how would you spend your time? And sometimes we're so far away from the things that really energize us. Mm-hmm. We don't even know. We don't have time for recreation. We don't have time. Get next to those things that are meaningful to you. Start to pay attention to the things you like and figure out how you can bring those into your work life and your workspace. Again, perhaps there's a chance that the circumstance that you're in, the place that you're working, is not the right place. I don't know. But a lot of times we just don't ask.
Yeah.
We need to ask. We need to explore how to make a more direct connection between those things that we enjoy doing, that we're good at, that reflect our strengths, and the work that we do.
Amazing message. Thank you. And I'm going to ask you exactly the same question for those leaders who right now don't want to take a poll of their workforce about their own performance because they think it might not come out as they dream it is going to come out. You know, for those people who have that reflective skill to say, I know my leadership is not great. I know that I'm in web of my head and it's not necessarily my fault. It's not necessarily because I'm crap. It's just I'm in this position right now. What should be the first few things that leader to start pivoting that leadership into effective leadership should do?
Be willing to be vulnerable. Followers like to see that you're human, mm-hmm. that you're not perfect, that you don't have all the answers, and that you have your own trips and falls, right? You have your own trip hazards. So really focus on making a human connection and step down off the podium, okay? and really just try to be. People don't think in terms of words like, you know, humanity and vulnerability and empathy when they think about leadership. Practice a little emotional intelligence and be willing to just open the space and rethink your leadership approach and perhaps your leadership brand.
Fantastic. Your book it's out now, isn't it?
Yes.
People can get hold of it now. Where can they get it? Access denied?
Yes. So if you go to the website, access-deny.net, all of the retail links are there. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can certainly go straight to Amazon to get it as well.
Brilliant. And if people want to continue this conversation or reach out to you, Brenda, how can they do that?
I'm on Instagram as Author B. Harrington, and I'm on LinkedIn And my direct email is bharrington@adaptiveleadershipstrategies.com.
Brilliant. And we can put that information in with the bio of this tag. Thank you so much. I'm going to get the book. I read a review of it and it said an easy read filled with stories that gathers us, wraps its arm around us and says to us, you are worthy. If that's not an incentive to get this book, I don't know what is. We wish you all the very best. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
It's been great to have you on. We know you're just outside Washington, so enjoy that environment as best you can.
Save me, please. Yes. Thank you.
Brilliant. Don't go anywhere, Brenda. I'm going to drag you back to the green room, but stop this recording. So thank you very much. Well, what an insightful conversation. Do you know, clearly you see Brenda's management and senior executive leadership coming through just in that conversation. Her firsthand experiences with issues involving diversity, both explicit and implied, and some of the circumstances she encounters with clients within organizations involving diversity, inclusion, and acceptance. You know, it's still a tough subject to nail progress in. It's still a tough subject to verbalize this whole area of inclusivity, diversity, equality, and to recognize when you're being excluded subconsciously, explicitly, or implicitly. You know, and I would ask you just to be aware of that. Be aware of how you are diversifying your team, how you are inclusive in your retention and recruitment, how you are equal in the contributing voices to that project leadership planning group, to that operation strategic thought. You know, let's see consciously if we can become intentional in our inclusivity, diversity, and acceptance. And let's face it, on the back of that conversation, surely we all believe it's good to have a coach, a mentor, a consultant helping us jump through the hurdles, the obstacles, the challenges that leadership and followership create. I'm a leadership consultant, a leadership coach, and I have a coach. I have a mentor who helps me with the challenges of my job. So don't think that anybody can live without having that coaching, counseling, mentoring, board of directors, as Brenda says, that board of counselors around you. If you're in leadership, be kind. If you're in followership, be loyal, be trustworthy, be honest, be open, be open-hearted to change. And remember, be adaptive. Try and pivot. In the green room after the conversation, I dragged Brenda in there and I was saying to her, isn't it funny that what we now call risk, you know, you're going to take a risk. This is a risky decision. This is a risk we're going to take. Actually, that's what I used to call spontaneity. That was a spontaneous decision. I'm going to do something spontaneous. And now it's become a bloody risk. I ask you, be spontaneous in your empathy, your compassion, your love. Be spontaneous in your humor, in your humanity. If you're in followership, be spontaneous in going above and beyond. Be spontaneous in loyalty to your leaders. Anyway, be kind to each other, ultimately. Enjoy your week. I am here next week with an amazing guest again. And until then, look after each other, look after yourselves, and I will catch up with you same place, same time next week. Thank you very much for tuning into the Life I Lead podcast. I really hope that something resonated with you today. If there's one thing I want you to remember, it's that you are also capable of being an inspiring leader. So I invite you to be fully present and fully alive to situations that may call you to step up and lead. As I say to everyone on my coaching courses, tell yourself aloud every day, I am enough. I am influential. I am a leader. Join us again next week on Monday at 7 a.m. And between now and then, remember the words of Eisenhower. You don't lead by hitting people over the head. That's assault, not leadership.